Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, David.
Is everyone awake and ready?
Yes.
Great. Please pray with me, O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ. Blessed Master. Dearest Mother.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Unfolding within my consciousness. And making me forever one with thee. When you sit for meditation, be sure to sit with your spine, your neck, and your head all in alignment. There should be a clear path that ascends from the base of your spine to the medulla at the base of the brain, and from the medulla across to the ajna. From the ajna, it swings around and comes up to the sahasrara, the crown chakra at the top of the head. Learning to meditate in the beginning means to learn to concentrate, to bring the full attention of the mind to a single point. And so we're taught to put our attention at the ajna, the point between the eyebrows. It's just a bit above the eyebrows. And as you delve deeper there, you can feel that ajna point. You may feel it as a pressure. There may be a tingling sensation. And you feel that begin to deepen. Now, the yogis over 5,000 years ago, perhaps much longer, discovered there is a relationship between the breath, the mind, and spirit. It also relates to the body. And this is a tremendous discovery, and one that is much underutilized. If more people paid attention to their breath, they would learn they could control their emotions, their physiology, their psychology, and enter into a deeper spirituality. So when you concentrate at the ajna, you begin to observe the breath, the incoming breath and the outgoing breath. This represents a polarity, a duality. And when you're in a very quiet space and you can really listen, you'll observe that the incoming breath has a different sound to it than the outgoing breath does. The incoming breath comes in at a higher frequency and the outgoing breath at a lower frequency range of sound. The yogis discovered that the vibration of words, the vibration of thought, and the vibration of spirit all have a connection. If you count up all the petals that are generally used to describe all the chakras from the base of the chakra up to the sixth chakra, the count is 50. And in the Sanskrit language, there are 50 sounds. And so there is a sound for each one of those petals, and the petals correspond to that particular sound or that particular vibration. And when you focus upon that sound, that vibration with consciousness, you begin to open those petals, you begin to open that center. You'll notice that young teenage boys in particular are attracted to a deep bass rhythm sound in music. And that corresponds with the bass chakras. It's not exactly what they need awakening. It's already awakened in them. And so, but that resonates there. And so that's that they're attracted to that. And it's of sensuality and sexuality. You listen to fine symphony music and you go from those same kind of deep basses, but then it takes you up into the higher ranges, and you can almost feel your spirit soaring as you rise up with it. And it's a very pure vibration. And so at the ajna, the yogis, listening very carefully, going deep, deep into that concentration and merging into those different states of consciousness, they described these different states with different words. And so what we are taught is Hong Sa. Hong as in Hong Kong, H-O-N-G, Hong. And that accompanies the incoming breath. And you don't try to control the breath with the sound. In other words, you don't try to change the rhythm of your breathing at all. You leave it totally natural. But as you breathe in, you think the word Hong. When you breathe out, the word that goes with that petal at the ajna, there are two of them, is Sa, S-A-U. And if you listen very carefully and you repeat those words, you can actually hear how those sounds resonate with the incoming breath and the outgoing breath. Hong goes with the in, Sa with the outgoing breath. And so sitting with a straight spine, settling the attention at the ajna, just gently resting it on the altar of the ajna, repeating the Hong, repeating the Sa. And its power is actually in its simplicity. It takes the mind and it begins to settle it down, focusing on these two vibrations. You see, the mind is used to being restless. And so it wanders up and down the spinal chakras. It has all kinds of visions. It has all kinds of sounds. It has all kinds of vibration that it's attracted to. But what you're doing is you're teaching it to be attracted to these two sounds which resonate with that ajna chakra. And you just let your mind rest there. And go deeper. It's not a strained kind of an affair at all. For instance, when you fall in love with somebody, you don't have to try to think about that person. Your mind naturally gravitates towards it. And what you're looking for is that bhakti spirit, where you fall in love with God, you fall in love with spirit. You fall in love with that higher vibration. You like it better than anything else. And when you do, it's not something you have to force. It's just something that you are positively attracted to. And so in your deepest prayers, you ask for that kind of attraction to be awakened within you. So that when you set aside your time for meditation, it's easy. It's easy. In fact, it feels like a deep, deep rest. It feels like a respite and a refuge away from the world's tumultuous character. and you find yourself being deeply attracted to entering into that quiet, into that silence, into that stillness, where the equanimity of mind reigns supreme. You don't go outside of yourself. That would be a misconception. As Papa told Mother, don't be like the restless monkey clinging onto its mother. So the mother jumps from branch to branch because sometimes the baby falls and then it gets injured. Be like the baby kitten who meows for its mother until the mother comes and picks it up by the scruff of its neck and carries it home. Become receptive. Become quiet. Let God come to you. Do not chase after God. But bring your whole attention into that still point at the ajna. And God will surely come to you and awaken you to deeper and greater states of consciousness. It is something that is so natural that you may not even realize that you're in such an uplifted state until you open these eyes and you go back into what we might say more worldly consciousness. And then you realize, my goodness, I was in a very uplifted state, but it seems so natural at the time you may not even fully comprehend what a state you were in. So it's natural. It's easy. It's positively attractive. And if your mind, because of old habit, becomes attracted to restlessness, just give it a rest as soon as you realize it. Release your hold on the restlessness and return to the ease. Return to the rest. Master used to call this the baby Kriya. And if you practice this, it will take you all the way to God. It should be imparted only by someone who's been authorized to do so through guru lineage. And this is something that Mother gave to me. And now I give it to you. A tool is only as good as the practitioner who applies it. But this is a supremely good tool. And even when you go about your day, when you're driving, you can put your mind at the point of the ajna and the breath and the hung sa, even while you're driving, even while you're doing other things. There may be people or meetings that you're involved with where people are talking on and on. And one of the most pleasant things you can do for yourself is put yourself into that state. Because there's not all that much you have to pay attention to on the outside. It's a wonderful, lovely practice. And the more you practice it, the more positively you will feel drawn to that inner state. Naturally, easily, gracefully, beautifully. Next week, we mark the anniversary of Mother's Mahasamadhi. I think this is the first time that it's fallen on a Sunday. So we've got a little different scheduling for next week, in that we'll have service at our normal time at 11. It won't be here. It'll be up on the north end of Seattle at Treva's apartment complex. They have a meeting room there that is quite quiet. Carla has directions for that I think we'll all need directions. I've not been there either. And then after that, we're arranging for lunch buffet at an Indian restaurant that's up on the north end. And then after that, we'll go out to Mother's Samadhi site. So it'll be a wonderful time, and I hope that you all can make arrangements and be there. I'd like to read from the Gospel of Swami Ramdas, dated October 14, 1957. Reverend Ralph B. Hamilton and Yogacharya Mildred Hamilton were expected at 8:30 a.m. From early morning, Papa had been busy with the arrangements for them in the new guest house. After satisfying himself with the arrangements, Papa came to Panchavati and sat under the banyan tree. In a short while, a car arrived and stopped near the tree. Papa got up and came near the car. Mildred Hamilton, who got down first, came to Papa almost in ecstasy, took his arm in hers, asked him how he was, and expressed how happy she was to be there. Ralph Hamilton also paid his respects to Papa. Their faces shone with joy. Papa, too, felt overwhelmingly happy to receive them, coming as they did from such a distant place as Seattle in USA. He took them to the rooms, inquiring on the way how their journey was. They said they were very happy, that they met some of Papa's devotees on the way, N.C. Pannell in Singapore, Ramachandra Gashanmandas and party in Ceylon, and Varagavan in Coimbatore, who were all very loving and helpful to them in every way. They entered the room, and immediately Papa asked for tea to be brought. "Now that you have come and have no more responsibilities in Seattle, you may stay here as long as you want," Papa said. "Mother, that is very fine, Papa." The conversation went on in a lighter vein for a while. They explained how it was made possible for them to come there, and how happy they were as their wish had been fulfilled. A side note there, that Mother and Father Hamilton had sold their home and everything that they had in order to be able to come. "Mother, Papa, I was sitting with you at the Seattle airport when I asked when we would meet again. You told me if the desire of the devotee is very keen, God will fulfill it." "How true, Papa. Otherwise, it would not have been possible for us to come here. We have come only for you. You are God in human form, I know. You would say that God is everywhere and that all forms are God's. But for me, yours is different. You are God Himself made manifest." Papa said, "You must be hungry. Have tea." Mother, "Papa, really, I am not feeling hungry at all. I am filled with God. God is my food." Papa urged them to take tea without further delay. So they went into the table, and Papa also got up. Thinking that Papa was going away from the room, Mildred called out a little loudly, "Papa, please don't go away. Sit here on the cot." Papa took his seat. "Mother, we have been thinking of you. We have been telling our friends about you. Papa, my guru taught the same thing as you tell us. I tell people that you are the ideal our guru taught. Is not Christ consciousness lower than cosmic consciousness? I mean to say, was Jesus Christ not in the dual plane?" Papa, "Christ consciousness is the highest consciousness. That is, cosmic consciousness. Jesus had a body, and that was the very manifestation of the cosmic consciousness. Jesus had often said, 'I and my Father are one. I am on my Father's business.' he maintained his oneness with the Supreme Truth, but at the same time said that he was the Son of the Father in heaven. He saw evil so as to set the evildoers right. He lashed at the moneylenders to make them give up their evil. Christ was the very personification of God. Mother, Christ was, and you are, Papa. It seems you had mentioned somewhere that it would take at least 100 years for Japan to progress spiritually. Papa, Ram Dass does not remember to have made any such statement. He has only mentioned in the book World is God that Japan should rise again and carve out a great future on the lines of the principles taught by the four great religions, Shintoism, Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism. Mother, well, I don't like the idol worship that is going on there. It seems when somebody goes to a temple there, he is supposed to clap his hands and make a sound to draw God's attention. Swami Satchidananda, in Hindu temples also, there are gongs which the devotees strike when they go for worship. Ralph, does this not show that they do not consider God as all-pervading? We are told that when somebody prays before an idol, his conception is that God, who is all-pervading, all-powerful, and all-knowing, has taken that form, as also all other forms. Does he really feel so when he prays? Papa, when a devotee stands before an image, he must feel that image is only a form of the Supreme Being. Through the worship of the form, he must go to the formless. Ralph, but they do not seem to think of the formless at all. They seem to be satisfied with the worship of a particular image. Papa, that won't do. Ram Dass has been telling everybody that idol worship is only a stage that has to be transcended. Mother, but they consider it as an end. Why should they have that stage at all? Papa, for children in the spiritual line, there must be something to hold on to. Those who crawl must get up and stand only by holding on to some support. Worship of a personal form is that support. If they do not have that support, they will never be able to stand at all. After they stand properly, they can give up the support. Mother, but they don't give up the support. Papa, take the case of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa. He was worshipping the image of Kali. Later he found her in himself and everywhere, with the result that he did not find any necessity to go to the temple at all. So one must go beyond the forms by worship of a form of God. It is not easy to think of the impersonal straight away. Many cannot. But Ram Dass is never for anyone worshipping a particular form of God all his life. That is not the purpose of image worship. You see what has happened among the Buddhists. Buddha condemned image worship, but his devotees made an image of Buddha and are worshipping it. It is impossible to give up image worship entirely. You must have something to cling to. Mother, Papa, I call him Father, pointing to Ralph. You are my Papa. I have love. He has reason. I give him a little of my love, and he gives me a little of his reason. Thus we are trying to balance love and reason. We have come here full. We want the final touch from you, so that we may be established in the divine consciousness. Papa, you will have it. You have come for that. You will surely have it. I want to point out here that Swami Satchidananda said in my conversation with him that, to his knowledge, that was the only time the Papa ever gave such a guarantee. Many would ask for Papa for that guarantee, but he would not give it. It is by God, I will read that again, you will have it, you have come for that, and you will surely have it. Mother, it is by God's will alone that we have come here. God told me that I should take him, Ralph, to him. Now I have fulfilled my duty. From now, it is your responsibility to look after him. Papa laughs. Ralph, Papa has very big hands to take on this responsibility. Papa, oh yes. Mother, I have love, but I cannot say that I've been able to love everyone equally. Mostly, I am successful. In a few cases, I've not been able to accept them as divine. I simply cannot. I know the fault is mine. One thing, even if they tried to do me harm, I did not take revenge. There I accepted your advice. Papa, revenge is not your nature. You are all love. Things do not always happen as we wish. Leave them to God's will. God knows best. The conversation continued for some time more when Papa asked them about the friends in Seattle, Bob Raymer and others. Papa told them that Raymer had given up his business and was going to make a spiritual colony in the land he had purchased for the purpose. Mildred said it would have been fine if Raymer also had come here. When the conversation was going on, Mataji came to greet the Hamiltons. Mildred embraced her warmly while Ralph paid his respects to her with folded palms. Papa told them briefly the daily program of the ashram, beginning with meditation at 5:30. He said, as Ram Dass' health was not good, he was not coming for the meditation so far. But from tomorrow, he will be sitting there. Ram Dass trusts you too will be coming. Mother, surely we have come for that. When Papa asked them if the accommodation was convenient, Ralph said that when they left Seattle, they expected nothing but Papa. So whatever they got by the way of convenience was above their expectations. It was past 10 o'clock. Papa got up and went for his bath. The Hamiltons came to Papa's room at 3 o'clock when Papa was taking coffee. They sat on the chairs in front of Papa. Tea was brought for them. Papa got up, opened his almirah, took out a tin of biscuits and gave a few to each of them, conversing all the time. The main topic was sale of Anandashram books in USA and Papa's proposal to see if anyone would undertake to bring out American editions of some books. Mother, you have mentioned somewhere that you have been to Ramana Maharshi and that by his look, your spiritual fulfillment was fulfilled. Papa, yes. Mother, we have come for that purpose. We are to get that type of influence and grace you got from Maharshi. Papa, are you in that state of mind as Ram Dass was when he stood before the Maharshi? Mother, I think we are. Don't you think so? Papa, yes, you must be. You have come with such an aspiration from such a different place, distant place. Again, I would like to point out that if you observe the conversation with Papa, there are many who say that they wanted to get that same look from him and same inspiration as he got from Ramana Maharshi. And Papa would ask them if they came with that same spirit. Not once have I seen where Papa affirmed that they had come with that kind of spirit. So I think in both these instances, Papa's response, which is not lightly given. A great master does not speak an untruth. And he would not just say it out of social convenience or to be agreeable. This is a great responsibility that a God-man has. And when he makes such a guarantee, he must stand behind it. This is a tremendous life that we have in mothers, in our gurus. It is a tremendous life because she, above all others that I know of, took Master's teachings, took Master's words, and really put them to work. She sacrificed everything. She was willing to go anywhere, to do anything, in order to have that tremendous God experience. And we can say, from our own knowledge, that she had that experience because we felt the power of God in her. Now, she operated through a personality. And as all gurus do, she used that personality. And to say she used it is a little bit of a misnomer. when you think of it as a personalized I. But God used it because she was totally surrendered to God. And she had that total aspiration to realize God. Now, sometimes when we as human beings bump up against the personality of the guru, we're left a little bit bewildered at times. We're not sure. Sometimes it raises doubt, sometimes extreme doubts. And this is exactly as it should be. Shirdi Sai Baba was an interesting God-man because there are times when people would come to him and they would be coming, and because he was known for miracles, they would come for healings, they would come for prosperity, they would come for all kinds of reasons that were something less than the total goal. And when you're in India, you discover that that's oftentimes true, that people come to saints for blessings. They want something. It's a little bit of an exchange going on there. I'll pranam to you if you give me what I want, in good health, in prosperity or money or success in a venture. But there are very few, really, who come for that total experience. And Shirdi Sai Baba used to say, I give them what they want until they want what I want to give them. Because what he wanted for them was complete and total realization. But he also knew, as Papa was talking about here with image worship, that people go in stages. We all have at one point or another. And we go through those stages. We should keep moving through them. As long as we realize we have not yet attained total truth, we should not cling to any of our ideals or our images of God too tightly. We can say that they are a transitional metaphor. This is the best knowledge that I have of God to this point. But when it is a product of the mind, we know that it cannot be anchored in absolute truth. Only when God reveals that truth to us can we stand on that rock firmness. When Peter acknowledged through his own experience that Jesus was the Christ, the Messiah, that had come, Jesus verified that inner intuition that Peter had had and said, that teaching comes from no man, but God has directly revealed that to you. I will now call you Peter the Rock. Now, we know that symbolically, that the rock that we stand upon is that revealed knowledge. It's not something we read in a book. We've not something that we've heard from anyone else, even a great master, even a great saint. It's not enough. Revelation of this sort must come as such a powerful and profound kind of movement that it goes to the very core of our being, that every cell of our body, every cell of our being sings out with the truth of what it is that we have been given. And as Jesus said, the truth shall set you free. And so that is the proof of the pudding, you might say. It's the freedom that you experience in God. When you realize what touching this truth can do for you, and the freedom that it gives to you, then you become very, very focused upon attaining that truth. You read scriptures, you read the stories of saints, you read inspirational materials for one reason only, and that is to focus your attention so keenly, so perfectly upon the divine that you open yourself to that revelation. You see, it is not that God withholds his grace from you, and then if you're supplicant enough and groveling enough and down on your knees enough, finally he relents and he gives it to you. That's a wrong way of understanding it. One of the movies made by Monty Python had the people getting down on their knees and groveling around on the ground, and God speaking as this cut-out character up in the sky. Say, get off your knees. What are you groveling around about like that? As if God would want that from us. As God would want that. It's not that, you see. The thing is our mind has become the barrier, has built up walls between ourselves and the divine. We have to learn to utilize this mind in a way that begins to unwind and unbuild what we have built. We have to take down those walls. We have to be willing to take down the walls. And when we are, we open an avenue for grace to operate within us. If it feels to us that grace is weak, if it's not very strong, if it hasn't demonstrated itself in our lives and our consciousness, it is not the fault of grace. It is our fault. We have not applied ourselves with greatest intensity. We have not really surrendered ourselves. It was interesting. I was talking to somebody who's following a different path, but the same as ours, really, going to God. And I asked him, I said, what is it that keeps you from having total openness to all the grace and prosperity that God would have for you? He gauged that he was at 90% openness. What would take you from 90 to 95% openness? And he said that greater acceptance and greater will would get him from 90 to 95%. I said, very good. I said, what would take you from 95% to 100%? And he said, acceptance and surrender would take him that final 5% of the way. And these are things that just spontaneously came out of his mind in the moment. They were not questions, I'm sure, that he was expecting from me. And I think he spoke a very great truth. Up to a point, we have to use our will. We have to use our mind. They're the things that God has given us. We don't have greater tools than that. But for that final 5%, we enter in through total and complete surrender. We let go of our will. We let go of the idea that we can do this. Up until that point, we try to organize our lives the best that we can. We have a regulated life. We get up at a certain time. We go to bed at a certain time. We eat the foods that are right for us. We practice our meditation morning and night. We live the good life, a spiritual life. But when we come to that final 5%, there's no place for the ego there. There's no place even for individual will. We completely and totally surrender ourselves to God. Papa is such a tremendous example of this, as we read about in Quest of God and in the Vision of God, his autobiographies. And we see there that there is a soul who completely lets go of planning, completely lets go of any notion of where he shall sleep, where he shall get his next meal from. He has no idea. And we read, astounded, even as Papa, I think, must have been astounded at times, in all the ways that God takes care of him. Papa, in all of his humility, describes how early on the path he's wandering through the jungles, and suddenly he has a hankering for a cigarette, a biddy. And a man walks up out of the jungle, doesn't say a word to Papa. He's got a rolled-up cigarette, hand-rolled cigarette behind his ear, walks up to Papa, hands it to him, lights the cigarette for him, and continues walking on his way without saying a word the whole time. And you can just tell that Papa is in total wonderment and amazement, even as we are, as we read this. God granting his slightest wish, even a thought that just flirtingly passes by the mind. And so Papa lived that life. Mother lived that life. Master lived that life. And we look at those lives and we say, are those non-entities? Are those people who didn't live life? And we would have to say they lived life to the full. They lived life maximally, if there is such a word. And it is a tremendous thing. Mother oftentimes said she lived life to the full. She enjoyed life. And she could fully and completely enjoy life because she was one with God. You see how the ego mind is so apt to twist things around and to say, oh, well, you become one with God, you die, you disappear, you quit enjoying life, you quit living life. Nothing could be further from the truth. We live life through inference. When we live life through the body and the senses, we get the power of God through inference, through form, through outer situations. They inspire us, they excite us, they depress us. Everything is lived on the outside. But when we live with God directly within, we cease living through inference and we go directly to the source. We plug in to that five, you name it, gazillion watts of pure life energy coming directly from the source. And really, that's what scares a lot of people. They think, well, I couldn't do that. And they would be right to say that in one way. The human mind and the human ego and the human body by itself cannot do it. It would be too much. But here is the secret, is that through our sadhana, through our spiritual practice, we learn to gradually transfer consciousness from physical consciousness only to the mind only to the spirit completely. We make that transference, and through making that transference, we grow, we expand. When many people begin to feel these higher frequency energies of divine energy flowing into them, they can feel overwhelmed. They can feel like it's too much. But if they would just let their consciousness expand, go beyond the body, expand out into all space, they would see that they could easily accommodate whatever it is that God is passing through them as they open themselves to that grace. And so we would say, in no man has ever seen God, because when you confine yourself to the human entity alone, you are blind. You look to the ajna and you see darkness there. But when the light comes to you, you see, you focus your mind there. And when you focus your mind there, you may see that beautiful yellow golden light coming. And it's coming to you. It's beaming to you. It's coming into you. And you feel its purity. You feel its power. And as you deepen, you may see there that deep blue, the deep blue, like a deep blue of the sky when it's very, very deep. And you feel yourself expand with that. It's coming to you, and then it begins to lift you and expand you. Not in a sense that you go outside of yourself, that's not possible. But who you define yourself as yourself expands. And it feels very natural. And you expand out with that Christ consciousness, that deep blue. And then that pearlescent white comes in, and you go out into a sea of light. And you go out and out and out, and you realize that all those circumferences, even expanding circumferences, are dissolving, and that there's no I and thou, there's nothing separate from you. You are completely one in that divine consciousness. And that divine consciousness is seen and felt to be permeating everything that there is. You see what a wonderful path we're on? You see how beautiful and perfect it is that Mother brought this path to us. Now, even when you're in a fully realized state, it's not that life always goes perfectly for you. Mother had many trials even after she attained that perfect consciousness. She had many things that were given to her that were very difficult for her to carry. And the reason is because through her form, God saw fit to be able to help lift the world, for the world to help work its karma out, because that karma, one way or another, needs to be worked out. But a great master like Mother can help this world. Even in my own small way, God has seen fit to give me some small loads to be able to carry. And during this month, it's been a very difficult time for the form. But the form need never dominate what you experience in God. The difference between realization and non-realization is you realize that God is always with you in whatever state of consciousness you're in. And that's not just an idea. It is a living reality. And so you feel that. I remember the first time that I heard the term that Jesus was in joyful communion with the world through his crucifixion. I never thought of it as being joyful before. But truly, if he could feel his oneness with God through whatever it is that he went through, then he would be in joyful communion, even if he was in pain. For as Papa said, pain and bliss are the same. Pain and bliss are the same. It's the same life energy, you see, that we experience pain through. And in its pure form, it becomes bliss. Now, this is a deep lesson for us to meditate upon and to learn to take deep within our own beings that all life is connected with God, no matter its form, no matter its form. And if there is some aspect of your internal life or external life that separates you from God, as Mother said, I know the fault is mine, that I don't see the divine in everyone. You see what humility she had. It is that kind of humility, because everything else is projection. Oh, if they weren't like this, then I wouldn't be having that kind of reaction. If they weren't being mean, if they weren't being this way or that way or demanding, then I could be happy. Then I could see God in them. It doesn't work that way. We got it backwards. It's not that the world will conform to our view, and then we'll be all right, then we'll be at peace. That our spouse will just act in a certain way, or our children will act just in a certain way, or that the world will no longer be at war, there will no longer be difficulties. I think you're on the wrong planet if that's what you're looking for. It's not happening here. This is a world of duality. Now, it doesn't mean that the world can't improve or that we can't have a hand in helping this world to improve. Surely we work for that end. But we also, through that process, we see God perfectly working out his plan throughout all this world. And when we look out through these two eyes and we find fault with everyone else and leave ourselves perfectly untouched by any sense of judgment, we're fooling ourselves. As Papa said, the ego is a grand fellow. He finds fault with everyone else and finds himself faultless. And isn't it true? Isn't it true? This humility that Mother had, she had such great love and such great humility. But you know, to meet her sometimes, it didn't seem perhaps that she is humble. She described herself one time when she met somebody, a great saint. And she was speaking with that saint, and she said that day God had quite an ego. And so she was talking about herself, and the saint finally pronounced to Mother, and he says, well, Mother, we must remember to have humility. And Mother made the point that humility is not something you wear like a suit of clothes. It's not something that you put on, because you can just as easily take it off. Those are my words, not hers. Humility is deep surrender to God. And for some people, for God to have quite an ego that day would require complete humility, because it would go against everything you think that a God man or a God woman would have. And so you might fight God on that. You might say, I don't want to look like I have an ego. Well, what an ego to think that you can't surrender to God on that score. So you see how subtle the mind works and how deep humility has to work in there. That total humility is total surrender. It's going from that 95 to that 100%. When you can totally surrender, and however God chooses to work through you, you do not interfere. You're the observer, and you surrender. And that is the 100% of surrender. And that is an apt description of Mother. And she was willing to play the fool. She was one time with another great saint, and she said to the saint, his name was Ashokananda, she said, "You know, I'm feeling so inspired, feeling like Krishna playing the flute, and we should all dance through the streets and play the flute and call everybody to God like Krishna." And Ashokananda said, "Well, you know, I'm a little bit old for that." And Mother said, "You know, I think I'm older than you are, chronology-wise. He says, "Yes, but you are you and I am me." So they didn't do it. But think of what God, if God called you to that. We watched a wonderful portrayal of St. Francis in a movie called Claire and Francis. And in the scene, Francis had turned to his life as a monk and he was begging. And he's walking by a tavern where all of his old friends who he used to hang out and party with and have good times with, and they were talking about him. And they were talking about the change in his life, and none of them with much approval. And one of them said, "You know, it would be easier if he was just insane, because then we could say he doesn't know what he's doing, but he's not insane. He does know exactly what he's doing." And the scene, as it played out, Francis took a deep breath and said, "God, give me strength." And he walked in there and he played the perfect fool, God's fool. And he just went in there with his hat in hand and begged from them. Can you imagine such a thing? Family, friends, going in such a state, which surrender? You see, it's not easy. It's not easy. It bumps up against something for us. And we want to look all right. We want to have the world's approval. But Master used to say that all the rest of the world could disapprove, but if he felt this is God's will, he would do God's will. And that's quite a statement, you know. What if the whole rest of the world told you you were wrong? But God was telling you to do it. Would you do it? Could you do it? Could you surrender? Could you have that humility? And so these are the kinds of tests, and every test is unique for each individual. I've told you before that when I first moved to the Seattle area and I was been practicing this path, and I first had an apartment that I could decorate, but it was just a single room bachelor's kind of apartment. I was going to put all the master's pictures up. I had a cloth and I was going to tape them, and it crossed my mind that all family and friends and whoever walked in through the door actually would see those pictures. And I felt a little shy about it. And so then I thought to myself, well, who's going to come and visit me here? So I went ahead and put the pictures up. And within the first week of being there, my mother, my father, my brothers, my grandmother, everybody in the world that I probably felt a little sensitive about came marching through to look at the new apartment. And so there I was. But once that happened, I didn't feel that shyness anymore. The whole world could see it. What did it matter, really? But you see how we can feel sensitive like that. Because it means so much to us. Now, this doesn't mean we should go out and deliberately dangle pearls before swine. We don't have to go out and tell the world our deepest, inmost yearnings and revelations. We should keep those deep within ourselves, because otherwise it can take the power and the purity out of it when we get the reaction of other people. When we become very strong within ourselves, then we can start to let the world see a bit more. But in the beginning, it's good to have a bit of a fence around ourselves. and not put everything out there for display. Because these are the most important things in our life. And we don't want to just deliberately put them out there and have others abuse us. But neither should we feel ashamed of our path or avoid things because God is calling us to them. When God calls us, then we need to respond. And if we don't, we put a barrier, we put a wall between ourselves and God. So let us think about and meditate upon this perfect surrender to God, what that means to each one of us. Let us emulate Mother in her total surrender and humility, and go from that 90 to 95 and that 95 to 100%, and that we feel completely and totally at comfort in our own skin, knowing that God is eternally with us and the masters are smiling. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet
and surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection
surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Peace. Bliss.